Captain Wright, Reel 3. You were saying that you thought it would have been a bit hypocritical to attend the official passing out parade.
Yes, it sounds petty, really, but I can't say that we had an antagonistic relationship, but I mean, some of the course officers were marvellous, but somehow we just didn't feel that it was consistent with our relationship hitherto somehow. Anyway, we had this four dissidents who went off on bicycles, I expect. I forget how we got there.
Quite a way from Aldershot to Bagshot.
Yes, I think it was. No, it probably got a bus or something, I don't know.
Was it the case that you were instructed mainly by officers, or were you instructed mainly by NCOs?
Well, I think almost entirely by officers. I suppose officers with NCOs. I mean, if it was a lecture, then I suppose it was entirely officers. But if it was a sort of field exercise, then it was NCOs supervised by an officer, I think. I mean, for instance, night wiring would have been that. Wet bridging would have been that. Assault bridging would have been that. Practically everything, yes. I think officers were mainly ultimately responsible for us. I mean, we thought an awful lot of them. There was a chap there who got killed later on at Saint-Nazaire, who was our MT officer. Pritchard, yes. We thought he was good. And a lot of them we did, but I think it was the sort of orderly room adjutant level and all this of it, which we found rather tiresome.
Was there a lot of formal business at the Octo in terms of entertaining, dinner nights, things like that, regimental?
Oh, good heavens, no.
No.
No, we were... I think it's fair to say that when we left Ripon as recruits who'd done our stuff and were considered fit to be soldiers, when we got to Aldershot, the message was, you may think you're trained and all that, but as far as we're concerned, you're the lowest of the low, which wasn't conducive to fostering some idea of responsibility and respect. I think that is possibly why we felt as we did. I think it was very much in the vogue then to sort of regard cadets in exactly the same way as recruits. You bash them around and tell them that mum wasn't going to come and tuck you in and all that sort of thing. Well, we'd done that. And I think, looking back, I think that's what we resented, really. There was no kind of feeling, OK, you're nearly officers, so we'll have some sort of mess parties or something like that, mess dues, you see. No, we were screaming and shouting, and as I said, given extra parades for this and the other. No, that was really what stuck in my craw, I think.
It does seem that there was a lack of continuity in the training process if you were going through the first few weeks all over again.
We were, exactly, yes, yes.
A bit of a wasteful effort, really.
Oh, awful, awful. But there were some wonderful, I forget the chap who did heavy bridging. He was great. He was very academic and had a dry sense of humour. A chap called Considine. He was wonderful. And the course officers, so to speak, were respected.
These were the specialists.
Yes, yes. I can remember one aspect which amused me a bit was the fact that in Aldershot Command you had to have a pass to get out of it, you see. And my parents lived in Wimbledon, actually. And I used to get a pass once a month, I suppose. And there was a chap called Newell, Corporal Newell, who was in the company office. And if you slipped him 5 bob or something, you could buy what was called a Newell special. And it was up to you to forge the signature of your company commander, whatever, you see. And you could have one of these. And so I used to avail myself of this every now and again and sign myself Fotheringay Major RE or something, and off I'd go. And I had to change at Waterloo from the Aldershot train on the train to take me to Wimbledon. And I may be exaggerating, but it seemed to me that whenever I had a what was called a Newell special, as opposed to the proper thing, there were always a couple of red caps there, and they'd make a beeline for me, and I thought, oh God, I've had it. And I hand this thing over to them, sort of quivering with anticipation of what was going to happen. And I got through every time, but I began to feel that MPs had a kind of third sense or something.
You never managed to run into the Major himself on the same train.
No, he was always fictitious, yes.
Yes. You passed out and you were going to India. How did you get to India?
Ah, yes. Now, we had leave, first of all. Then we were summoned to the RE depot, which was in Halifax. And it's all a bit dreary, I found. We used to turn up on parade at this fairly large house in its own grounds. We'd stand on the lawn and look bloody miserable, and then we'd go through some purposeless exercise of more or less, you come here and while you're here, you might as well do something, and then we'd be dismissed about 10 and we'd go to the pub or something, you see. So it was a rather dreadful existence. And again, we engineered something. What was the fellow called? A wonderful bloke. And we decided we wanted to get to the flesh pots. So we'd have a wonderful system of communication. And we'd get our friends up in, who remained in Ripon, in Halifax, to communicate with messages at the various places that we were going to be in London, you see. And you go into some pub or a club or a restaurant or something, and any messages for blogs, you see, and they say, no. And we'd managed to, we weren't allowed to do it, of course, we managed to have two or three weekends down in London, which was great fun. But the rest of the time, it was pretty aimless, really. And then I can remember this poor chap, I suppose he had this dreary job of being running this depot office. I forget, he was a captain or something. And somehow or other he communicated to us and we had to turn up there at a particular time. And we were all standing there looking pretty nonchalant and he suddenly arrived with great dramatic aplomb and said, "Gentlemen, the orders arrived," and just to say that we had to go and climb onto this ship in Clydebank. So off we went. But poor Philly milked the last drop of drama he could get out of this really very mundane development. I can remember one of the most vivid things, getting onto the. We went out on the Durban Castle, which is about 17,000 tons or something, and motor ship, which wasn't marvellous. But there it was, moored in the middle of the Clyde estuary, and we got off the train in Gourock, and the tender to take us out to the troop ship was a McBrain's paddle steamer. Wonderful looking thing, and I can remember distinctly it was just a thing for day trips. It had the main deck went from stem to stern without any obstruction at all, and the bridge, which literally was a bridge, was a sort of structure which bridged this continuous deck, you see. And on this, with sort of wind cheaters and all the rest of it, was a McBrain's captain and his lieutenant or something. And we all filed on. We were like a lot of sheep, I suppose, on this thing, all crammed in. And off this wonderful vessel went, you know, the paddle steamers, the most elegant things, I think. And we arrived alongside this ship, and we backed and filled until we were fairly close, you see. And this skipper, who had a wonderful complexion, rather like that rug there.
Very ruddy, then.
Yes, he was, I think, a Scotch whiskey fan. I don't know, he may not have been, but anyway, he was a great character. And he looked up at the empty bridge and of the Durban Castle and said in a stentorian voice, "Isn't somebody going to throw me a bloody line?" And a few seconds later, the wing of the bridge appeared a little pink and white Merchant Navy cadet, aged about 15, I suppose, or 16 or something. And he said, "You've come the wrong side." And there was a pause of a few seconds, and then this chap burst into the most wonderful, unrepetitive swearing I've ever heard, in which he questioned this chap's forebears and all the rest of it. It was wonderful, and it went on for, I don't know, it seemed like a couple of minutes. And when he dried up, there was a sort of another few seconds silence, and then without any collusion at all, we all spontaneously cheered. Whereupon he turned round and gave us sort of version two of this wonderful diatribe. Ah, great. No, it was fun. Dead boring in between, and not particularly frightening at that stage, but I suppose one welcomed any kind of break like that.
Anything out of the ordinary would be welcome.
Yes.
What was the Durban Castle like? What was your accommodation like on there?
Oh, we had... I was in a double cabin with five blokes. One on the top bunk each side, and one on the bottom bunk each side, and then a bloke on the floor in between. So we're pretty close. It was... I mean, we were on that thing from the 9th of... December, 41,
yeah.
Yes, until the 28th of December, of January, sorry, 42, and so we were sort of part of the ship by the time we got to Bombay, but...
How did you keep yourself occupied when you were on the ship?
Ah, yes, now you may ask that. I played bridge, assiduously, practically all day, with, I forget, there was one other bridge officer and two Poles, and they were great blokes. Another thing was, I suppose, yes, in between this, the CO ship, whatever they called him, OC ship, was a half colonel in the Cameron Highlands, and he organised Scottish dancing, which I knew, and of course there were no women on board, so you can Scottish dance to all men, and we used to do sort of foursome reels and Duke of Perth and all that sort of thing, which is highly physical.
A full body contact sport.
Yes. So there was that. Oh, I suppose they had we had Christmas on board, and they must have had pantomime or something, so it was all very well organised. It was a long trip because we went 2/3 of the way across the Atlantic before we went south, and we went into Freetown, and didn't come off the ship there. We just refueled, I suppose, and then we went to Durban, where the people were marvellous. We were there 4 or 5 days, and they entertained us, and oh, they were terrific. I would say that we left Clydeside on Pearl Harbor Day, which wasn't very sort of auspicious.
Did you hear the news on the very day?
Oh, indeed, yes, yes.
What sort of impression did it create?
Well, I don't know about everybody else, but I wasn't too happy. And then, of course, we also got the news of the sinking of the Prince of Wales and the
Repulse,
which wasn't fun. Yes, it was a bit grim.
Were you part of a large convoy?
Indeed, yes. I was very impressed, because I'd been very keen on the Royal Navy, and I knew practically every... I didn't know about the ship, but I knew the class anyway. And we had the Ramillies. Well, first of all, we had the Ramillies all the way up to Freetown, that's right. And then we had enormous escort. We had one of the Akak cruisers, Caledon, I think it was, and we had destroyers, and we had in the first stage, we had an aircraft carrier as well. So we were well looked after. In fact, after Durban, when we split into two, I suppose one half of the convoy went to Bombay and the other went to Suez or Port Tewfik. We had with us the Dorsetshire, who was sunk 4 months later. But she was a splendid ship. But it was everything was novel at that age, and so I felt sorry. Well, I feel sorry now for people who were older. They must have thought it was perfectly awful disruption. But for us, it was just novel.
Were there any alarms on the way for enemy submarine or air action?
Well, going across the Indian Ocean, I can remember a strange vessel went straight across from east-west, while we were going sort of north-east, and we thought it was a bit odd, and the Dorsetshire became aware of this, I suppose, and she came screaming back and followed the thing over onto the skyline. And a bit later, we heard gunfire, and we presume it was a raider or something, I don't know, but that was the only thing we heard. I think the Ramillies, at one stage, must have detected one of these condors. I think they were the first name, anyway, these long-distance German planes, and it let off some of its Akak equipment. Sure, blimey. It may have been an exercise, I don't know, but it was pretty impressive.
Who else was on the ship on the Durban Castle? Was it a specific engineer's draft, or was it...
Oh, Lord, no. Mixed? No, it was totally mixed. Totally mixed. There were troops on board as well. We didn't. I wasn't in charge of any. I was just a sort of passenger, and I, so I had no duties at all.
What happened then when you got to India? You landed at Bombay.
Yeah. So one of the things we did was we were told that most of the kit that had been issued to us in Halifax was totally outdated. It wouldn't be used at all. I've still got a pair of shorts which I was issued with in Halifax, where they had turn-ups of about 6 inches, and they were so long that they had to have buttons. They had aluminium buttons on both sides of the leg. And come 7 o'clock or dusk or whatever, you would roll these down, tuck them into your stockings. And they were bizarre, they really were. But the other thing, of course, was we had Woolsey helmets, which were totally useless. And I think those were committed to Bombay Harbour, I forget now, but...
used to be the pith helmet.
Well, no, they weren't even pith, because we had pith helmets when we got to Roorkee, and I wore a pith helmet in the desert, too. But these were these sort of great big thing with a sweeping back right the way down over the nape of your neck, and, they looked ridiculous.
What was your first impression of India? You came in through Bombay, what do you think you made of it?
Well, having been there, 10 years ago, remarkably unsmelly. I forget now. Well, we weren't allowed ashore very much at first. I can remember we had to have parades. Somebody came, some general or something, came to look at us, and we all had to turn out on the dock, and then we went back again. No, I can't remember. Because as soon as, if we weren't parading in Bombay, we weren't allowed to go ashore at all, really. We got straight on the troop train. So, I can't remember really seeing very much of it. But we saw the gateway of India, and I think we must have gone into the Taj Mahal hotel at some time or other. But there were so many of us, I doubt if we'd have managed it. No, I don't think we did very much. But we pretty well got straight on this train, I think.
Where did the train take you?
The train took us up through Delhi, up to Roorkee, which was our regimental depot. I think I've got to put some...
What happened to you when you arrived at Roorkee?
Oh, and I can always remember. We were about the first largest party of new officers that came in. About eight of us, or maybe half a dozen, and they laid on a sort of introduction course for new officers, I suppose. And I remember the first lecture we attended was the history of the Corps. That was the Corps of Indian Engineers, which is three, I think they were called groups, according to the old companies, East India companies, presidencies. There were the Bombay Sappers, the Bengal Sappers, and the Madras Sappers. And I'd opted for the Bengal Sappers. And so we were given history of the Corps. And when lecture number two came along, a wonderful fellow who later became my colonel, well, he was a colonel of the training battalion to which I was posted in Roorkee. And then when I was in the desert, he became our CRE, as it was then, commanding what is now an engineer regiment, I suppose, a chap called John Blundell. And the subject of his talk was how to buy a Persian rug. And that was typical of him. He was, I think... A characteristic of the Corps, especially those who joined the Indian Army, is eccentricity, but very benevolent. You see, I'd hardly been there a week, if that, when there was a knock on the door, and in came a hawker with a whole crowd of rugs, you see, and... I knew nothing about them at all. But thanks to John Blundell, this wonderful colonel, we were forearmed, which was, I think, a wonderful introduction to the place. And the second thing was I was asked, I can't remember by whom, possibly him, I don't know, no, I don't think it was, Do you play bridge? To which I replied no, because I'd had a basin full of it on the troop ship. And he looked a bit crestfallen. And so he said, do you play polo? And I said, yes, I never played polo in my life, but I'm a reasonable horseman, you see. So I started polo. And, wonderful, wonderful. It really was. I mean, I don't play it now. I wouldn't play it in this country because I think they've got the wrong approach. You've got to be a fat cat with no kind of charity to other people. I wouldn't cross the road to watch polo here. But regimental polo was disciplined. We used to... I had a charger, which I used to use for polo. I had a polo pony, and I had a half a share in somebody else's horse. I paid the extra food, and so I had three ponies. And I used to play six chuckers of polo every... did we have it every day? No, three times a week, I think it was. And it was enormous fun. And, of course, I should say what a beautiful place it was. It was on the plains, but so close you could almost touch it. It was Nanda Devi, 26,500 feet in the Himalayas. There's snow on it. Oh, wonderful. And what was so wonderful was the whole atmosphere of the cantonment. As one was having one's bath, which was in a galvanized bath about this long, with water poured into it by one of your servants, I'd lie in this thing and hear the jackals coming into the cantonment in the evening with their rather mournful cry, punctuated every now and again by bugle calls. Somehow I'm reminded of Betjeman's thing, summoned by bells. We were summoned by bugles. And they had boy soldiers who would go around a bicycle with a bugle and call from about four places in the cantonment, each particular call. And I found it fascinating.
Where were you living? Were you in a barrack block or in a bungalow?
A bungalow, which was a sort of new structure, a kind of box really, but not an old-fashioned bungalow. That was all for the what were called the borough sarbs, the
senior officers.
Yes.
So you were a chota sarb at that stage.
Oh, very much so. Yes. Yes.
You said you had two lectures on the introductory course. Do you remember what other subjects were covered on that introduction?
I can't. It's awful to be so selective, isn't it? But they were fairly mundane. Mm. But how to buy a Persian rug, I thought, was so wonderfully original. Great chap. And fortunately, I mean, there was another side of the Indian Army, which I liked very much. My sort of distant cousin, I forget what his first name was, he had married and had a fairly posh bungalow. He was a captain, major, I forget now. I was asked to dinner there, and who should be the other guest but my colonel? And it was so, not democratic, it's a dreadful word for it, but one felt part of a family, which is very important, I think. Now, I'd have done anything for John Blundell. He was a wonderful fellow.
When were you first introduced to soldiers?
Pretty well right away. I was in charge of... I was in a...